Thank you for coming tonight. This is the first in what hopefully will be a series of community labor events put on by the Labor and Working Class Studies Project, which was instituted a few months ago. A bunch of union people and academics at the university got together and talked about how the University of Wisconsin used to be a scene of labor studies, industrial relations, and School for Workers, of course, is still there, often by a thread. But there's a tradition there, going back to the days of John R. Commons, etc., that has been allowed to dissolve in recent years. And so the idea was to restart a project. It's called a project because there's no formal organization yet, just a bunch of people working together who want to reconnect labor and the university and the community. And so tonight, their first effort to do that is with Amy Dean, a co-author of this book that you see on the screen. And before I forget, or because I probably will, I need to plug Rainbow Books, which is selling this book tonight. So be sure and get your copy if you haven't already gotten a copy. And even if you've gotten a copy from the library and read it, buy a copy too. I am also asked to read the mission statement of the Labor and Working Class Studies Project, which is the collaborative campus labor community initiative to connect the campus and the community in dialogue and action on issues related to labor and working class people. Pretty simple, and I'll give it back to Patrick because he might forget otherwise. It is my honor to introduce tonight's guest, Amy Dean, who's going to be talking about a book she co-authored with David Reynolds called The New New Deal, where she takes both her experiences and the experiences of many other local labor movements around the country and explains how you can connect labor, grassroots community organizations to develop real regional power. I first heard of Amy Dean or heard her name back when she was made the executive director, was that the title, of the South Bay Labor Council. I read this somewhere. This was back in about 93, before we had internet or email in our office, so it wasn't on the internet that I read it. It was in a labor paper or a news release or something. And they said this young woman, age 30 years old, had been elevated to the top position in the South Bay Labor Council. My first reaction to that was, that's pretty neat, young and female. I knew that we had done stuff for the previous 10 years in Madison to revitalize our labor council. I knew there was stuff going on in Milwaukee with Bruce Colburn revitalizing that labor council. And when I say revitalizing, it's like actually vitalizing compared to what labor councils had become in the decades prior to that. And you got to remember, this was 1993. Lane Kirkland was president of the AFL-CIO. Labor councils were basically the red-haired stepchildren of the labor movement. They were there mainly because they had always been there and not because anything was expected of them, and very few were actually doing anything. Now, to me, South Bay Labor Council, not being a Midwestern guy, I've been to California several times, but I don't really know what they call places, didn't really mean anything in terms of the geography or anything. So my first reaction was, oh, this is neat, a young person, a female. And then I thought, well, maybe that's what we've come to, that some kid out of college was grabbed and made the head of this little labor council that doesn't do anything because nobody else would do it. Well, I was disabused of that quite rapidly as I began to see more and more about the stuff that was going on in the South Bay Labor Council in San Jose, which turns out to be, I think, the second largest labor council in California, if I'm not mistaken. And it wasn't, you know, some backwash that, you know, had to take this girl because nobody else would do it. At that time, as I said, the labor councils and state feds to a somewhat lesser extent, but especially labor councils around the country, were largely moribund. But it turns out that also at that time, there was stuff going on, but we didn't know about it, except, you know, we knew what was going on at the other end of I-94 in Milwaukee, but I didn't know what was going on. There was no communication system between labor councils or from the national AFL-CIO, really, to labor councils about what might be going on that you might want to replicate or talk to somebody about. It turns out, slowly, I began to find out more about stuff, and by the time John Sweeney was elected president of the AFL-CIO in 1995, he recognized that something was going on. It wasn't just Madison and Milwaukee and South Bay. It was Seattle and Atlanta and Houston and various other places around the country where labor councils were becoming revitalized, taking a much greater role in politics and legislation and basically bringing working people's issues to bear on local government and local economic development issues and the like. And as when you read the book and you get to the last chapter, unfortunately, you'll find that the national labor movement, the national AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, while he recognized there was something going on, and it was a good thing, he didn't really connect the dots, and they still haven't connected the dots. And one of the best parts of Amy's book is she explains how the dots can be connected in order to rebuild power, not just regionally, but in this country for working people. I realize there's a few faces here I don't recognize, and I didn't introduce myself. I'm sorry. I'm Jim Cavanaugh. I'm president of the South Central Federation of Labor, which is about as descriptive as the South Bay Labor Council. And we have 97 local union or local labor organization affiliates in a six-county area in South Central Wisconsin, representing about 45,000 workers. So we aren't South Bay, which has around 100,000 workers and has done tremendous things that you're going to have to read the book to find out about them or pull them out of Amy tonight. But with that, I do want to introduce Amy Dean, one of the best minds and best organizers in the progressive movement in this country today. Amy.
Thanks, Jim, for a really warm introduction, and he really has said it all. I'm going to sit down now. He's said a lot of good things, but I want to do a couple things before I start tonight. The first thing I want to do is I want to ask people if they could move forward, and as you're moving forward, if you don't mind getting up and moving closer, we'll make it a smaller room. If there's a sign-up sheet going around, can you sign up your name, and most importantly is your name and your email. And if you have a business card, what would be the most helpful as you're moving forward, pass a business card up front, because for me, the most important thing about these kinds of meetings is being able to keep in touch with people after tonight. And so it's my hope that tonight's not the only time we get to communicate with each other. So if you could pass your business card up or any just a written piece of paper with your name and contact information, that would be phenomenal. A couple of thank yous before we start tonight, certainly to Jim Cavanaugh, who you'll hear more about tonight, because the work that we talk about and the work that I'm going to describe really is modeled off of some early initiatives that took place in Madison and Milwaukee back in the 80s, and when these interesting federations of labor across the country that Jim speaks of were looking to think about what kind of work we could do around the country, we did look to places like Wisconsin that were sort of in the lead back in the day. The other thing I want to do is just acknowledge Rainbow Books, and it's already been pointed out, but you know, there's very few places anymore where books can get purchased and bought, and I really want to thank wholeheartedly Rainbow. I make no money from the sale of these books, so this is no personal interest here, but thank you to Rainbow, and I really do hope you buy books to support independent bookstores. And again, I make no money off of this book. It's no self-interest here, but to please support your independent bookstore so that we're not just all reading what Amazon thinks we should or shouldn't read. All right, I think that's enough, and I'm waiting for the cards to come forward, and please feel free to do that, and I'm going to get into it. There's three things I want to communicate tonight, and it's sort of embedded in the title of this PowerPoint, and I want to make three points. The first and foremost is that I speak to a lot of groups about what I think it will take to really rebuild a progressive America, an America where we have the kinds of public policies and the kinds of leaders that many of us in this room hope for and dream of and certainly don't see on the national front lines. And when I speak to groups, people are often frustrated at the end of the presentation or at the end of the speech, and they say, well, you didn't tell us what the message is. You didn't give us the message. You didn't tell us what our message is. And so if you're here tonight to find out what's our message, what do we do to have the teabag side on our, you know, what's our teabagger movement? The answer tonight is that there is no magic bullet. There is no short-term way of getting us out of where we are. And there is no message, as important as message and communication is. But the presentation tonight is about how we need to rebuild the front lines in America, how we need to rebuild infrastructure, civic infrastructure. And that's the first and foremost point tonight. The second point is that while progressives may be having a very difficult time finding their voice at the national level, progressives locally are having no trouble finding their voice, and we'll talk tonight about a lot of exciting things that are happening in this country, where progressives really do have a voice. It just may not be at the national level. And the third point that I want to present tonight is that, and you can take umbrage with this, that it can't happen in the absence of a strong, revitalized labor movement. And that labor and collaboration with community need one another. But in the absence of a labor movement, in the absence of labor revitalizing itself, we will not have a middle class again in America, and we will not have a vibrant democracy. So those are sort of the three points to take away from the title. That, we have to win the battle of ideas, but ideas and communication in and of themselves are not enough. We have to have infrastructure, and we have to rebuild it again. And don't wait for Washington, and it has to be labor at its core. Okay, so that's sort of what I'm going to talk about tonight. We'll go to the next slide. There's no little clicker, so I have to communicate it manually. So a lot of people write books. Like, why did we write this book? Lots of people write books. And when you write a book, you find out that everybody in the world's written a book. And I'm not an author. I'm an activist. But there's reasons why we wrote this book, and there's reasons why we think it's important. And first of all is that not enough activists write about their work, and too many people who are not activists write about our work, and somehow we don't really communicate what's happening. The business community often writes about its work, and it tells stories about its best practices. And the business community has a vast infrastructure for proliferating best practices, and it's not a mistake why it's such a successful institution. We can argue that it has all sorts of benefits that working people's organizations don't enjoy, but the fact is that they invest in massive infrastructure and proliferating best practices, and we don't. And that's one of the big reasons for why we wrote this book. A guy in Singapore figures out a better way to do accounts payable, and boom, overnight, anybody who does accounts payable hears about what he's doing. And we don't do that enough. And when we do tell our stories, we only tell about what we did well. We don't tell about where we failed. And that's why we wrote this book, because we have to share best practices if we're going to build a vibrant social change movement in America. The second thing is that we have to share the lessons of not just what's working, but what's not working. And too often we tell the glorifying parts of the story, we don't tell the hard parts of the story. And I want to talk to you tonight about the 22 years of work that I've done in the labor movement, where I have witnessed personally working people being able to take on chambers of commerce and manufacturing groups, and how we can build organizations that say it's not just your purview to decide how the economy grows and what jobs get to grow and which jobs don't. And I've personally been involved in that, and I want to share my personal stories tonight because I think they're inspirational, and I want people to know that they can do this work. It's not rocket science. And then lastly, I think a lot of times people get very depressed because they feel like there's not things happening on the ground that we can take example from, that we can rebuild, we can model it to our own communities. And let me just say, there's no cookie-cutter approach to this work. It looks different in every community. But there's enough of this work taking place where I think we can speak of a model that can be replicated. But we write this book because we think there is things going on that people can be excited about and not only disappointed about what we're seeing at a national level. Okay, so that's why we chose to write this book. And everybody has their own ideas about why write a book, but those were ours. So so there's some major premises in the book, and I'm going to share them with you tonight in case you choose not to read it, but just buy it. And here's sort of the basis of what we believe. We believe the book presents a strategy where real people in real communities can build power. And build power not just in a way where we protest and we oppose, but where we can govern and promote policies and actions and define the economy in ways that make sense to us. We think that, so the book is very much about how to. Here's a strategy for how to do something. We also assume that organized labor, in spite of its setbacks and in spite of the fact that it is not in a growth phase, it still is the only institutional player in this country that comes close to spending the money that corporate America does, and very close in political elections. And so it's very much about resources, and we'll talk more about that tonight. But the other sort of premise of the book is that organized labor, in spite of the setbacks it's experienced, is a major player and has to be challenged if we're going to build progressive power in America. And that there can't really be a revitalization of a progressive America absent the labor movement. And we know what populism looks like from a right-wing perspective, and we know that that's frightening. And so whether we love the labor movement or hate the labor movement, it's a necessary institution to be revitalized. And there was an interesting thing. John Wilhelm, who is head of the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union, often says you can have a trade union movement in America without progressive power, but you really can't have progressive power in America without a trade union movement. And then the last point tonight about this book is that we say that in order for labor to renew its fortunes, it has to become as much a community-based organization as it is a workplace-based one. And that, in other words, it can't just be an organization that defines itself by its role in the workplace. It must be also an organization that sees its role as a player within the broader community. Those are the four big ideas in our book. What do we know isn't working? I became a parent 12 years ago. I raised three children. I'm a single mom. I've learned many, many things, mostly more failure than success. But here's one thing that I've learned in the 12 years that I've been a mom. When something doesn't work, don't do more of it. It's that simple. Teddy, don't do this, and Teddy still does it. Don't yell louder and expect a different outcome, okay? And I sort of feel like that when we, you know, not to be in any way disrespectful about the challenges we have as a progressive movement, but when things don't work, why do we keep doing the same thing over and over and over again? And so that's a question that I've often asked. And what are the things that we know doesn't work? We know that investing all of our efforts in electoral campaigns, where we work really, really hard for a really short period of time and spend all of our resources and have very little left at the end of the day, is not the way we're going to build power. Now, how many people think if we have three more votes in the Senate, we'll get a better health care bill? If you really fundamentally believe it, it's okay, raise your hand. Or if we have a bigger majority in the Congress, we'll get industrial policy in America. Does anybody believe that tonight? Because if you do, it's fine. I just want to know, does anyone believe that? You're an easy audience. You're going to make it way easy on me tonight. I guess I'm in Madison. No one's going to challenge me. You better challenge me from the left then if you're not going to challenge me from the right. I'm usually challenged by the right, not from the left, so I'll have to see how I do. But the point here is that parachuting people in, what did we learn in 2004? We had the best organized political campaign. I'll talk about the Obama campaign in a minute. But when we ran the John Kerry and the Kerry Edwards ticket, at no point was the Democratic Party and the labor movement more organized in the field in decades. And why? And we still lost. Now, there's lots of reasons to think, lots of ways to explain it. But let me make one very simple point, and it goes back to the premise tonight, which is we have to rebuild infrastructure on the front lines in America. When a person goes door to door and makes them, and the messenger is my neighbor, versus a college kid that got parachuted in from another part of the country that doesn't speak with the same accent, it almost doesn't matter what the message is. It's the messenger and who you have, you believe in. We're all human beings. We're all human beings, and that's a very basic point. So in 2004, we had the best infrastructure ever in our history, and we lost. And in 2008, I will argue that going forward, we've dismantled even further our infrastructure on the belief that this charismatic president and the fact that we own the two houses of government are going to be what changes America. And so in some ways, we're set back even more. But the point here is this is what does not work. And this is where we, as progressives, put the majority of our resources. Next slide. Look at this. All right, I'm not going to get into the detail because tonight's is for you to speak, and I don't want to get into the whole analysis. But look at, can you see what the labor movement, just the labor movement, spends on political campaigns year to year? Look at these resources. It's enormous. It's very significant. And can you imagine, why are you guys laughing?
I didn't realize Greg, as a political organizer, was making $600,000 a year.
And I guess part of the argument tonight is that all of you, many of you tonight, are from local unions. And I still believe that the labor movement is one of the most democratic institutions in America. And these dollars, the hundred thousands, the millions of dollars that get spent, here's how it works in the labor movement. They come out of workers' paychecks. These are not dollars. When you spend $1,000 at a Democratic Party fundraiser, it represents the nickels and dimes that have been commingled by labor unions to buy that plate at that fundraiser. When you sit down at a Republican Party fundraiser for $1,000 a plate, it's usually one guy, and a white guy, who bought that plate, and the whole table. So the point here is that so much of what we're going to talk about tonight is about resources. We're not going to rebuild civic infrastructure absent real resources. Yeah?
Is that hard money, direct candidate contributions, or does that include like soft money?
It's both.
Member to member.
It's member to member communication and direct contributions to campaigns and direct contributions to the Democratic Party. I would argue today that it's really not complicated. If the labor movement pulled all its resources out of the infrastructure of the Democratic Party, there would be no infrastructure for the Democratic Party. And I don't know if anybody would challenge that tonight, but if you do any electoral politics and you're in the labor movement, there is no Democratic Party outside of the labor movement. So the point that I'm here to make tonight is that if even a fraction of those resources were redirected into local infrastructure, we would be in a very different position today, and some of the things that I'm going to talk about are not hard to get to. They're very easy to get to if we can talk, because it really comes down to resources. It's not about rocket science. It's about resources. Okay. So we wrote a book, my co-author and I, David Reynolds, who is an instructor at Wayne State University, and we said that we saw some interesting work going on around the country, and we call it regional power building. And here's what regional power building is and what we define as a region. We say that a region is an entity, a jurisdiction that's larger than a neighborhood and smaller than a state. And what we mean by region is that there are many things that impact workers' lives. Affordable housing, transportation systems, the kinds of jobs that get retained or attracted in a region. And these decisions that are made are often made across multiple cities' jurisdictions. Nobody really plans a transportation system city by city. So there's lots of political decision making that goes beyond sort of the political boundaries of decision making. In other words, you can really speak of a region as more an economic set of boundaries, and I don't want to be so technical, but simply to say that a region is something that's smaller than a state, bigger than your neighborhood, and there's an enormous amount of decision making that goes on every day at a multi-county level or at a county level that affects working people's lives. And so we think in our book that it's the region that activists should be thinking about and in terms of targeting their activism and the work that they do. And we say that there are sort of three legs to the stool of regional power building. And when I, and I'll talk more about my personal experience, but in 1993, when I became the head of the Labor Council, we brought our executive board together, which was 22 labor union leaders, and we said, how do we want to be seen 5 to 10 years down the road by our members, by working people in general, by elected leaders, by media, even by industry? How do we want to be seen as a labor movement? And we said things like, we want to be seen as smart, and we want to be seen as powerful, and we want to be seen as credible, and we want to be seen as leaders. And we said, do we think we're seen that way today? And our leaders said, we think so. And then we polled our members, 400 union people and 400 working people, a universe of 800 people in the Silicon Valley. And we said, what's the most important thing to you? And interestingly, there was no difference between what union people and non-union people said. Working people said things like, our jobs are important to us, healthcare is important to us, having affordable housing is important to us, having the ability to get to and from our job is important to us, having affordable education is important to us, and having decent quality of life. And we said to those same people, do you think your union is involved in any of those things? And they said, absolutely not. Or to the non-union people, we said, do you think unions are involved in these things? And they said, absolutely not. And then we said, do you think your union should be involved in those things? And people said, no. And so what we realized is we had an enormous credibility gap, and that leaders were out of touch with their members. And we said, you know what? If we want to be seen as smart and credible and as leaders and as respected and listened to, then we better have a series of capacities that we don't have today. And the first thing we said is we better have alliances with people, because we know that the messenger is more important than the message. And so we better have coalitions, and I'm going to talk about coalitions tonight because I almost wish we didn't use that word anymore, because they really have become, it's a meaningless definition of what I mean by the kinds of relationships we need to have across labor and community to build real power. But we said we need community leaders and community organizations to not only be the messenger, but to see us as being credible partners. And so we need to figure out, how are we going to build more meaningful coalitions? We said we need to have research capacity so that when the business community runs around the county and says to the public, to the press, we're doing really well in Silicon Valley. We're the economic miracle of America. And one of the metrics that we use to make that case is that median household income is rising. And all of us look at each other, because working people are very smart. We're not stupid people. We say, that might be true. And that's because more of us are living together in the same house. But we need to be able to not just anecdotally make that case, we need to make the case. So we better figure out how we're going to have a research capacity to challenge what we know anecdotally and what we know with what we see every day of our lives. And we better have a policy capacity, because too often we get into these situations where the first time you meet the labor movement is when it goes down to City Hall to build a power plant in your neighborhood. And then we wonder why we don't have a good relationship with the community. But without a policy capacity and simply the capacity to react to what's being proposed, very difficult to build the deep coalitions. And we said, you know what? This political action capacity that we have, as big as it is, it's really not getting us much. So we said, we need to build these three legs to the stool if we're going to be the things we want to be that we said when we brought ourselves together as a board. And we gave birth to something called regional power building with these three legs, and I'm going to talk more in detail about it. So how did we go about it in San Jose? Well, the first thing we said is, if we really do want to tell the story about the region looking differently, then we're not going to be able to develop this research and policy capacity under the roof of the Labor Council or under the roof of a union per se, because we already have a lot of things that we have to do. We have to represent the interests of our members, and we have to represent the interests of local unions. And so we created a separate entity, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which, by the way, the right wing creates all the time at the local level to advance their interests. And so we created an organization called Working Partnerships, and we thought that represented what we were trying to do. And we created our own 501c3, and we said we're going to create that organization so we can have our own research and policy capacity. And I'm going to get more into that tonight, but that was the first thing we did. And the second thing we did was we said, you know, if we're really going to develop deep coalitions, then let's build this organization and share governance with the very groups we say are important to us. So it's not just about reciprocity and calling groups when you need them to come out for your picket line and then turning out for their events when you need to go down to city council. But let's build an organization where built into the DNA are the very partners that we want to govern with over the long haul. And so we created an organization where the Board of Governors was made up of both labor and community. It sounds like it's a no-brainer, but it was a new idea for us in the labor movement. And then we said we're also going to need to create some kind of capacity, which I'll talk about more in a minute, where we can actually, beyond just sitting on a board of directors together, really begin to understand the interests of one another and really plan for how we're going to, over the long haul, govern. And then we said, our political action's not working. We're electing people. They want us to be there to do the heavy lifting, but they're certainly not calling us when it's time to do the heavy thinking. They want us to be part of their electoral coalition, but they certainly don't see a role for us in their governing coalition. And so we said, we're going to need to establish these three legs. These are the three legs. These are the ways we want to do it. We said, we're going to create our own separate entity. We're going to put on the board of directors a combination of organizations we want to go alone with for the long haul. And we're going to start cultivating our own people. But that doesn't mean we're just going to call so-and-so from the CWA and so-and-so from the machinists and say, run for office. Or, get our own people there. Because we've all been disappointed by getting our own people elected. That in and of itself doesn't do anything. But we're going to create an infrastructure to support them. And so those are the three things we did. And I'm going to go one level deeper with how we did it. Okay. So the first thing we did was we said, why is it important to have the policy and research capacity? The research capacity is important because we need to be able to tell our story. And so we were able to begin to tell the story that employment was at record-breaking highs, but the quality of employment was low. And so one of our first victories was not just the enactment of one of the first and highest living wage ordinances in America, but to this day, we continue to harvest every single contract and every single employment relationship that government creates by attaching conditions to it, by attaching living wage conditions to it, healthcare conditions, and the ability for people to unionize. But we could never have made that case if we weren't able to demonstrate that the majority of jobs growing out of the region were not allowing people to live. We had to make the case. Very much like we need to make the case at a national level that it's not just about creating jobs, it's about improving the quality of jobs. And so many people pass living wage ordinances all across the country, but in the absence of being able to make the case long term about job creation and having an organization on the ground that continue to harvest the victories, then those policies in and of themselves are meaningless. And so the point here is not just to say what the victory, but what goes into making those victories meaningful and lasting long term. I hope I'm making the connection for people. The second thing is that on healthcare, we passed one of the first universal healthcare plans in the country where, independent of immigration status, it doesn't matter whether you have documentation or no documentation, kids get insured. When you, in Santa Clara County, sign your kid up for lunches at school, you also sign them up for health care. And we did it with a public option over 10 years ago. And we didn't put Blue Cross or Blue Shield out of business. But we did it because we had the capacity to develop policy, develop program, and not just stand up and say, we need health care. But we developed a series of technical capacities that allowed us to get the money and build the program. And so part of what I'm trying to demonstrate with sort of the three legs to the regional economic development or regional power building stool is how deep it allows you to win. On transportation, with the policy and research capacity we developed over a decade, we understand the transportation budget in our region better than any organization, even as good as the people that create the budget in the region. Why is that important? Because you know where to find the money. And so, for example, here's an interesting connection that I want to make. Because we understand the transportation budget so well, and because so many people depend on that, that when anti-union attacks are made to eliminate bus lines because bus drivers are making too much money, we can make the case that eliminating bus drivers has some relationship to eliminating most important served communities that depend the most on transportation. And so then it positions labor to be in a very different place, where we're not just defending, you know, $30 an hour guys who have pension and health care when the rest of the region doesn't, but that we're also fighting to defend heavily dependent regions, areas, neighborhoods in our community where transportation means the difference between getting to or from your job and whether you have a job or not. None of those kinds of victories, again, could have been possible without the kind of capacities that we have built over the long haul. And then another important victory for us that we like to talk about is how we're able to link land use decision making to affordable housing and redefining the definition of affordability so it's not just about housing biotech workers, or I guess that's the case here, that biotech is growing in this region and that industry has an interest in having affordable housing stock. Industry has a big interest all across the country in affordable housing stock because it competes for knowledge workers around the world. So quality of life issues are very important to the business community. Even though business operates in a global context, quality of life is very important. And these regional decisions are very important to the business community. And so these issues around land use and what kinds of houses get built, where transportation systems move back and forth, what kinds of welfare, social welfare system or not, is very important to these guys in spite of what we think about the business community. And why that's important is because there are deals to be made. There are deals to be made if we're building long-term power and have the capacity to make those deals. This model of regional power building, the three legs to the stool, has done more than just create victories in California and in San Jose. The other sort of model that grew alongside working partnerships in California that's been incredibly successful is something called the LA Alliance for a New Economy. Again, building itself very similarly to the way working partnerships built itself. And they not only have accomplished these kinds of things that you can read up on the slide, but let me just make it clear about what happens in Los Angeles. No land use decisions are made in Los Angeles. No public investments are made in Los Angeles in the absence of there being some measurable return to community, and without community negotiating with the developer or the private investor on what kinds of returns will be made. I see a lot of money and investment going on in this community. I haven't been here in a while, and there is lots of money being dumped in. My hotel is very fancy. It has Maitland Smith furniture in it, which is a very expensive line of furniture. There's a lot of money since the last time I've been here, and there is resources being poured into this community, and I'm certain no return to community or very little, given the investments that are being made. And the examples in LA, which is so significant, and it's a slightly different model from working partnerships, but there's been so much progressive power built in that city that literally, like I said, decisions are not made in the absence of there being a return to community. And how many times do elected officials stand up and say, I'm going to make an investment of taxes or I'm going to subsidize jobs because our community will benefit? And there's often very little measurable return, or very few organizations or people that are set up with the capacity to even measure the return. In Los Angeles, they not only from the outside, as being on the outside, make the case or try to argue with developers, but they actually almost dominate progressives, labor and community, dominate the redevelopment agency in Los Angeles. And again, would not have happened without their ability to understand redevelopment and tax increment financing, without their ability to be able to link that to political action, and without their ability to have alliances strong between labor and the community. Now, a lot of people say, well, this is great. It's all California exceptionalism. California is a liberal place. And you know what? It's great, but you can't do that outside of California. You can't do it in the South. You can't do it in a place in, like in Denver where there's no union density. And you can't certainly do it in a place like Boston where the building trades dominate politics. It's an old post-industrial city. You can't do this stuff. And let me tell you, a big impetus for this book is because as we began being successful in California, raising foundation money, trying, because we couldn't do this all without additional resources. We raised foundation money, money from unions, even money from corporate foundations. People started to say to us as our organizations began to mature, well, this is great, but you can't really do it outside of California. Part of the reason why we wrote this book is to demonstrate that people are taking the model and they're replicating it across the country. And so what's interesting is that when a model does exist and people write about it and talk about it in concrete terms, then you're able to be able to actually progress at a faster pace. And so these organizations that I'm going to talk about, Georgia Stand Up in Atlanta, an organization called in Denver called the Front Range Economic Strategy Center, and then an organization in Boston called Community Labor United are half the age of these California models that I just described, and their ability to have deeper victories exists because of the models that have been created and their willingness to share best practices with one another. So interestingly, in Atlanta, I want to talk very briefly about this. The Atlanta Federation of Labor said, we want to do something similar to what's been done in California. And they created a 501c3 called Georgia Stand Up. And they went and they said, we want to build the very same capacities that have been built by these organizations in California. And they did. And one of the things that they were able to do early in their inception when they were first born in 2004, a year later, the city was negotiating a big belt green line around the entire city. And they were able to, in collaboration with labor and community groups, define the conditions of what kinds of housing, what kinds of open space, and what kinds of jobs got created within that belt line. And so written within the policy framework that created the Beltline, jobs that get created have to pay a living wage, they have to give people the right to organize should they choose, and they have to have health care attached to them or they don't get to grow up in that Beltline with any kind of subsidy or support from local government. Affordable housing has to meet conditions for the lower half of the hourglass within the region, not the upper half or the middle. And so people said, you can't do this work outside of California. And there's a very successful organization, Georgia Stand Up, that continues to have victories based on the model it's created. And people said you could never do that in the South. And now they have sprung up seeded several other projects throughout the state of Georgia. In Denver, interestingly, a very similar organization that I talked about, the Front Range Economic Strategy Center, created by the local Federation of Labor in collaboration with community groups where there's very low union density, not a strong labor movement, where they were able to take an entire manufacturing base that was gutted, where a rubber plant used to exist, where they got 8,000 construction jobs created, 350 affordable housing units, and the jobs that are being created long-term, again, living wage and the ability to organize should the workers choose to as condition. And in Boston, the most recent victories, two very significant victories. In Boston, the organization that was created there called Community Labor United, they are a very interesting combination of building trades unions, which people say is the most conservative part of the labor movement, and community-based organizations. And the most recent victory that came out of their organization is that all the weatherization and renewable energy money that comes down from the federal government through the state will now come directly to Community Labor United. And here's what these guys are empowered to be able to do. It's incredible. Incredible. The neighborhood groups go door-to-door and they canvass. They identify all the low-income housing homes where people need weatherization. They cluster them together so that large contractors can then go and do the work, so it's not mom-and-pop operations. And the problem is that then there's no quality control, right? This is a great example of this is in New Orleans, where people are trying to rebuild their homes in Lower Ninth Ward, And because there is no sort of bundling of homes that need work to be done, you get ripped off by these contractors that come by and say, I'll do the work for you. And the next thing you know, like, there's no way to hold these guys accountable. So large contractors that are certified and licensed and union, but there's requirements on minority-owned union businesses as well, will now be able to perform the work. And they've created financing mechanisms that through state government, Community Labor United, working with the state of Massachusetts, is creating the financing so that more than just bubble wrap is being put up on people's homes, but there are real retrofits that are going to go on around the weatherization. And I guess the point to all these victories is that how often have we said not all of these interests can get satisfied? How often have we said, look, either, and let's use the Boston example, you can weatherize people's homes, but it can't be done at the prevailing wage. Or you can do this, but people are going to have to pay for it on their own. You know, we can't finance this. But when you build organizations with the constituency that you're trying to serve and meet at the very outset, that's a different kind of coalition than we're going to reciprocally support one another. Does that make sense? I mean, if you build an organization and sitting at the table are building trades unions, community-based organizations, communities of color, immigrant-based organizations, and you say, we are building organizations together to be bigger than the sum of our parts, and we're going to marry that to a series of sophisticated capacities, the victories become bigger, and it demonstrates that we don't have to be, you know, what's the word I'm trying to find? Fighting for the scraps, that we can have bigger victories. So, you know, it's hard in a presentation to go into every single thing that went into these, but I'm trying to demonstrate that there's a common model, common capacities, common coalition partners that are leading towards significant victories that actually do make us feel excited that progressives have a bigger voice than what we're seeing federally. Okay, next. A deeper look at how these three legs work together, drilling down a little bit more. Let me talk about it in a little bit more specificity, and then I'm going to try and wrap up. But I don't want it to be general. I want to try to be as specific as I can. How the research works. There's been enough of these research reports that have been created around the country where we tell the tale of two cities growing side by side, or two regions growing side by side, where enough of these reports have been done, and I'll show you resources where you can go, where there's actually templates for doing this research. So you get a graduate student, you give them the template. Here's one sitting here. Maybe you're not a graduate student. I don't know. Maybe you're a professor. If I misrepresent you, I'm sorry. Maybe you're a professor and I'm just getting old. But there's grad, it's not rocket science. There's lots of graduate students. You look confused. Okay, I'm sorry. There's enough of these templates now where you can tell the tale of two cities in your community. Now, why is it important? Because whoever tells the story, whoever writes the narrative, whoever does the research gets to propose the solutions. When you get to demonstrate that traditional measures of economic success, that the business community, the chambers of commerce, and these new, more gentler, hipper things that are called Vision 20 whatevers, or these collaborations at the regional level that seem so progressive and liberal, and they're not. They're fancy ways of industry meeting its needs. They say that if we create economic success and we look at the traditional metrics of economic success, which is industry doing well, that automatically translates to community well-being. What we've been able to do, what all these organizations that have had victories across the country, and they've had many losses, but the reason why they're being successful is they can demonstrate that because applied materials is doing well, it may have no relationship to our community. And that if you can show that economic success of industry has been delinked from community well-being, then you pave the road for these kinds of public policies in a much more compelling way. It depends on our ability to demonstrate that these things are no longer linked. So that when elected officials say we're going to invest in biotech, and those are the jobs of the future, we say, yeah, but there has to be a return to our community. And then people say, well, biotech, this is the future. And we say, I don't know about you, but it's no different to be a janitor in a low-tech firm and a high-tech firm, and it pays the same thing. Because the truth of the matter is we're not changing the structure of employment because we're bringing in different industries. We have to change the quality of employment. And we don't get to make that case and pass these kinds of policies unless we have the research capacity that tells the story. every one of these communities that I've talked about and 20 others across the country all have reports that they start their work out by. Step one is we have these reports that are called Growing Together, Drifting Apart, or The Tale of Two Cities, or whatever you want to call it. But the point is that we demonstrate that just like in the Obama administration has in the reinvestment, I did this interview today where we deconstructed what's happening with the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and while there may be some success taking place, even if we got back to the period of where we were in the 1990s where we had record low unemployment, the fact is we have to demonstrate that the jobs that are being created today, the majority of them, are not allowing people to make a living. They're just allowing people to barely get by. The majority of people that take welfare in America today have jobs. They're not unemployed. You can't simply say that unless you have the research capacity to tell the story. And so in each one of these examples, people are able to generate very important reports. And then what they do with them is that we're going to talk a minute about what do you do with these reports. So what's so different about it? All these reports, they go up on people's shelves, they collect dust. What's so different about this report you're telling us about? What's the big deal about being able to tell the tale of two cities? Use the basis for the research to begin to educate the activist base in your community. How do we do it in San Jose? It was a very basic way we did it. Took a page out of the business community. We created something called the Labor Community Leadership Institute. It's not a hard thing to do. We went to San Jose State University. We asked the chair of the political science department to create a program. We said, we have a series of research projects that we've been generating, and we want to begin to educate labor and community activists and leaders, and even people that may not have conversations with us around these research reports, and we want them to get continuing education credit. You could do that here. We don't want them just to think that the gals at the Labor Council are telling them about the economy. We want to make this legitimate. We created something called the Community Labor Leadership Institute, and we used the research that we generated to begin to educate people on it, and to be able to begin to talk to people about what's happening in the economy. And together, hundreds of people have gone through our Community Labor Leadership Institute. Together, we begin to understand what are the forces of the economy that are at play, what are the levers that we can affect politically, because that the forces of the economy are not governed by physical laws of nature as much as industry wants us to believe that, but they're decisions are made every single day about what jobs get created, what jobs go offshore, what jobs are going to stay here and be subsidized. And those are all decisions that are made on land use decisions often. Land use fuels the kinds of jobs that get created or not created. Subsidies or tax increment financing or redevelopment dollars decides what's going to get the bump or not get the bump. And our ability to begin to share with people how these things work and begin to relate to each other and learn who each other is and are is very powerful. The business community does this stuff all the time. It's called the United Way, or it's called these Vision 2020s, where they bring people together to get to know one another, and the relationships between industry leaders and public policy officials translates into public policy decision making. Personal relationships translate into public policy. It's not rocket science. Business does this every day. So we're not doing something that's so uncomplicated, but we're building research capacity. We're sharing it with people in a formal way through a leadership institute, and we're creating relationships. We're creating value added for groups to go back and educate their membership. We're creating relationships that we need over the long haul. And we're beginning to cultivate a confidence among people that we know as much as the other side knows. So when we talk about the deep coalitions, it goes beyond simply building the organizations where we govern together. But these leadership institutes are very important. They're a key leg in creating the long-term coalitions. So again, whoever tells the story gets to present solutions. You have to be able to talk to more than just yourselves. You have to be able to talk to unlikely suspects, and you do it by creating official educational programs that you run and you govern and you use and you convene. And lastly, what we did in San Jose was we started creating research policy proposals, and they began to become the basis for our political endorsements. The labor movement has a lot of power. It's very Pavlovian. People will do for us what we ask for them on the front end. So if we're disappointed what they're doing when they get into public office, it's because we didn't calibrate the expectation properly up front. So if your endorsement process says, will you pass cross a picket line or not? And that's what we get once we elect someone, that they'll not cross our picket line. Then shame on us for not doing more to get people to think about what they should do once they get to office. So in San Jose, we created public policy strategies around housing. We did it with our community partners, and we did it in our community leadership institutes. We created policies around transportation and what kinds of jobs we wanted to be created. And we began to use those things as a basis for our endorsements. And again, it sounds like, well, that's not really a big deal, but labor makes endorsements every day of the week, and it convenes candidates. And it says, you know, and they come in and they proffer the proper platitudes, and we vote for the guy who says that inspired us. But we brought every single person who pulled papers to run for office through our community labor leadership institutes. And our endorsements began to be way more sophisticated. And we set up the expectation among elected officials that don't call us just to do the door knocking. We expect to be part of your governing coalition. And by the way, we're building more of a policy and research capacity than you will ever have with your 1.2 staff people. So those are sort of more details about the three legs, how we went about it, going one level deeper, and then we'll try to wrap this up. All right, so great. Those are great stories, a lot of information. We'll read the book. Okay, it makes sense, but, you know, how do we get from where we are to where we're going to be? There's no national network that's going to get put together to create these models across the country. It's only going to happen if groups feel inspired, if they want to build something different in their community, and they want to win and have bigger victories. So it's going to be people in this room. Don't look around. Look to each other. It's not going to happen outside of this room. But how do you get to where you are today, to where you want to be? Well, the first thing is that you make a decision about who are the real groups you want to work with. Who really has real capacity in our community? Who has a base? Who really represents real people? And who are those groups? And you come together, and you plan. And you say, okay, based on who's in the room, what do we have of these things that you've talked about today? What capacities do we have sitting in this room? And what capacities do we not have? And you make a list. You do an audit. You know, there's all sorts of people here that probably map and create typologies for a living. Do it for something useful. No disrespect. No disrespect. And for the academics in the room, I'm sorry. Look, people know how to create typologies. They know how to create landscapes. Do one of the groups sitting in your in the room, right? What capacities do we have that these groups all seem to share in a common way that we have in our room, and what do we not have, and what do we have to build? And based on the fact that I'll show you resources at the end, that enough of this work has matured across the country, you can do it with starting with one staff person, one graduate student, that begins can help do the audit, that can begin to do the research, start talking about what's happening in the local and regional economy. And you need one first staff person to do it. And it doesn't take a lot of resources to pull that together. It doesn't. And there's unions, if they put small resources into it, one or two foundations, and you're off and running. And I know it sounds simple, but the money's out there. The money's out there. We can talk about where you go and where you look for it. But the money's there. And sometimes it's already being spent, it just needs to be redirected. And then the point here tonight is, where does the other support come from? The whole notion of what you're talking about tonight, of marrying university and community and labor, is a powerful combination. And if organized properly, not in a loose-knit committee, but in a real organization, real infrastructure, that is sort of the basis for how all these other groups got started around the country. And then there is an organization, and we'll then wrap it up with some of the resources that you can go to, called buildingpartnerships.com. And this curriculum that I just talked about, and the template for the research is all online. It's all online. You can go to this site, and if you don't like what you see on the site, you can call me and say, you said it was there, we didn't see it. And the template for how to do the research exists. The curriculum for the Community Leadership Institute, even though you will all adapt it differently in your community, it's been documented. I mean, the work is getting old enough now where it exists, it's been documented, and you can find it. So, obviously, there's a lot of pieces in between, but get your core group together, do an audit, create the landscape, find out what you don't have, pull together the funding for your first staff person. It's not that complicated to do. We can talk about it tonight. And then there are resources where some of this stuff has already been documented and you can use it in your own community. Okay, next. I want to wrap it up that there's no shortcuts to this stuff. It's what I started out by saying. If we're going to really rebuild power in America, we have to rebuild the front lines. We have to build a different kind of social change organization in our communities. We have to build a more sophisticated type of social change organization. It's got to be labor and community. And we have to be able to go toe-to-toe with chambers of commerce and national manufacturing association groups. And we won't do it with a loosely knit coalition. We have to do it by building organization and infrastructure and institutions. And my belief is that if we create these kinds of regional organizations across the country, we'll do more than if we get three people elected to the Senate. It's not to mean that we abandon the national agenda, but we really have to build local infrastructure. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. I mean, I sort of spoke of the three big legs to the power-building stool, but it looks different in different communities. And so the point here tonight isn't to say that you do what we did in Silicon Valley. The industries are different. The relationships are different. The dynamics are different. What works in one community doesn't work in another. But there's a sort of template for what could happen. And again, it took us a long time to get into the mess that we're in. We're not going to get out of it because we have the right magic bullet, the right message. There really hasn't been a progressive America for over 60 years. And the right wing understood something that when they lost in the Goldwater years, they said, you know, they said communication and message isn't enough. We have to rebuild our infrastructure. And they've been doing that for a long, long time. And any doubt about it, they don't have the presidency. They don't have either the House or Congress. And they still have enormous influence and power in America. Real quick about the presentation. There's nothing I said tonight that isn't already in that book, but in greater detail. But we know that not everybody reads books, so we do presentations too. But again, we hope you'll buy this book to support Rainbow Books, who will sell it to you cheaper than the publisher, which is Cornell University Press, and funded by a group called the Century Foundation. And one little thing about Cornell University Press, it's the publisher of this book, and here's why. When you talk about the labor movement, or you're from the labor movement, people think you're stupid, they think you're dumb, and we could have had any progressive press in America publish our book, but we said, you know, we're going to go to the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval to give us the legitimacy and the credibility. Some people don't care about it, we cared about it, and we want people to understand that this is not just a bunch of gals in South Bay, California that think they know what they're doing, but that, you know, Cornell thinks that this model is useful, and they published it. And by the way, we're the second top seller of the entire Cornell University Press, this book. And nobody reads this kind of stuff, but the only book that's selling more than us is labor posters. There's no words to it. So not bad. We're second top press. And we went there, like I said, because, you know, I'm not an academic, but we wanted people to know that this stuff's legitimate. Okay, last. So here's some resources for you, because people like resources. Let me go through them real quick. Campaign for Responsible Development, that's the group in Denver. Some people may say, well, that we're more like Denver, we should look to what they're doing. The group in Boston, Community Labor United, this group is amazing. I talked to you about their Green Jobs Initiative around weatherization. That's their website. Building Partnerships is a website, a little out of date, but again, it has the template of the Community Labor Leadership Institute curriculum online. You don't have to recreate it, but you would obviously need to adapt it for your region. It also has the template for how to do this research. We put the Century Foundation up there. I don't know what they do, except for they gave us the money to do the book, so we put them up there. It was nice of them, so we had money to write the book. Working Partnerships is the organization that I founded in San Jose, and I think there's none of the research, none of the reports, anything that I've talked about tonight in real life that you can't find on there. Every single research report that we've done, how to do children's health insurance, how to create the program is on there, how to do these research projects, it's on there, how to create housing policy that brings together tenants, rights people, and affordable housing people who are normally never on the same page. All of it's on there. The South Bay Labor Council, which shouldn't say San Jose Labor Council, South Bay, it's the same thing. That's their website. The other sort of grandmother in this story to Working Partnerships is Lane. That's their site. And then lastly, the group in Atlanta, Georgia Stand Up, that's their site. And all really, really good stuff. And there's almost no excuse to not be able to do this work, given how much of it's been documented and how many real people are in the field, combined with the story here that we tell. and hopefully, you know, people will be inspired to act, and we'll answer questions and talk, and Patrick will tell us what the next steps are.